Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College Online Journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Make sure not to miss a single podcast and subscribe to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast, at iTunes, Google Play, or your favorite subscription service. The views expressed in this presentation are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of the U.S. Army War College, U.S. Army, or Department of Defense.
Welcome to A Better Peace, the War Room podcast. I'm Genevieve Lester, the DeSerio Chair of Strategic Intelligence at the U.S. Army War College, and your host today. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Today we are discussing intelligence and the war in Ukraine. And we welcome Ken Stallworthy, the director of the Russia Strategic Initiative at U.S. European Command. Prior to this position, he was National Intelligence Manager for Europe-Eurasia at the ODNI. He retired from the U.S. Army after 27 years of service. Joining Mr. Stallworthy is Professor David Geo, who is Visiting Professor of Intelligence and International Security in the Department of War Studies at King's College London. He is Associate Professor of History at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, where he also serves as History Fellow for the Army Cyber Institute. David is Director of Studies for the Cambridge Security Initiative and co-convener of its International Security and Intelligence Program. It is argued that the war in Ukraine marks an inflection point in the use of intelligence in combat. And we see this in a range of ways. So let's talk about a few of them. Beginning with the term democratization of intelligence. This is an interesting term that both of you write about in a recent article. What started your interest in this concept?
Well, thanks, Jen, very much. If you'll indulge me for a moment just to explain why I wrote the article. I've had a burr in my saddle about this for a little while now, and it was based on some personal experience following the Ukraine war very closely. As an outside academic, where I was following along for several months, and then I felt like I had a good sense of what was going on in a pretty granular level of detail. But then, as a Navy Reserve officer, I eventually went for my reserve duty, and I went into the SCIF, the secure compartmented information facility, and logging onto the so-called high side systems, I realized that there was actually very little I didn't know about what was going on, and I'd been noticing this trend for a while as a reservist who followed foreign affairs closely in my real job as an academic. And then on my reserve weekends, I'd log on to the high side about once a month. And again, just realizing, you know, like I did before with the Ukraine war, that there just wasn't a lot that I didn't already know. Not to take anything away from some of the absolutely exquisite collection and analysis that the U.S. intelligence community can do. But in the main, I just felt like, I was pretty well informed. And actually, because I had read a lot of academic journal articles or think tank pieces from outside experts, I actually felt like it was the U.S. government systems that were missing a whole lot of insight and analysis that wasn't reflected on the high side systems. And so I'd been thinking about this for a while now, and it just finally bubbled up, to an article for Engelsberg Ideas about the Ukraine war in particular.
Yeah, Jen, if I could just offer, David was the starting point on this entire thing, and his term democratization was handed to me. And again, he did the bulk of the work on this article. But I looked it up to make sure I understood where it was going, and it's the action of making something accessible to everyone. And so it certainly fits that in what we tried to describe in the article. But I'll just give my very quick story of back in 2014-15, as I was monitoring the situation in Ukraine, upfront and personal, I was also watching the emergence of Bellingcat at that point. And their, I believe, 2016 study on the Buk, and it was extraordinary, as Dave was talking about, of the ability for them to take open source information and analyze in a different way than we had seen previously. And I took that into my current job. And I believe we've gone well past that sort of 15, 16, 17 period with an actual war going on and the ability of this democratization to be spread really across the world.
I'd been feeling that the delta between what militaries or intelligence personnel know and what the outside observer knows, or maybe better put, can know, if they know where to look, if they know who to follow. If you have a pretty good internet connection and you know where to where to look on the internet, what experts know what they're talking about, you can really do pretty well. And I would hazard a guess that it's not that different what's going on in major briefing rooms versus, let's say, a think tank event at RUSI or at IISS or somewhere in the States as well. So I think that delta is narrowing, and we're seeing that really on full display as we observe the Ukraine war.
I think it's a fascinating case study. Can you talk a little bit about what it looks like? What does democratization look like? You provide some very interesting examples throughout your article and drawn from sort of our daily reality. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I think, part of this, of course, is the internet and social media platforms in particular. And, maybe it's a different podcast to talk about all their negative externalities. But looking at conflict and trying to understand and analyze why that is, it's connected citizens and experts around the world to collect information, to analyze information, and to compare notes, and also I think to stress test each other's analysis, which might be a polite way of sort of looking at two experts fight on Twitter, right? That's essentially what's happening, right? Is they're peer reviewing in a version of the term other people's analysis. And so, for me, the elements are that, why is it democratized? Well, information is ubiquitous. It's readily accessible. It's cheaper. It's free. It's decentralized and it's crowdsourced. And I think everyone can essentially be a censor, either wittingly or unwittingly. And just, Jen, you were asking for an example. And there's a great example that was on TikTok on February the 5th. And there was a man in Russia walking his dog in the snow. And he saw some missiles passing by on transport vehicles, and he took a picture of that and he uploaded it to TikTok, with a sort of like, what on earth is this? And then that made its way to a Russia expert at RAND who said, oh, those are Iskander missiles and they're headed toward Ukraine. And so, there are lots of these things where, the collector, in a sense, doesn't actually know what they're looking at, right? But someone at RAND or someone at the Center for Naval Analysis or someone at a think tank or at a university, right? They know what this stuff is. And so you've really sort of connected an analyst, an outside analyst with an outside or sometimes inadvertent collector. And you have this sort of magical synergy there that the rest of us really benefit from.
If I could just add to David's explanation there, it's not just the think tank or academic experts that can be relied upon. I think what we've seen here in this democratization is there's a whole bunch of people who like to look at weaponry or formations or even flots as a hobby. And either it's because they did it in a previous job, or it's just a passion that we see again as part of the internet. And so I think that's part of the newness of this is, as David saying, anybody out there with that internet connection can see what the true experts might want to weigh in on a specific issue, or they can look for these new self-identified experts. And as David said, and there's some self-policing going on. So there's certainly some phonies coming up. There's certainly some people out there from both sides that have information operation objectives in putting out information. But what we see in this crowdsourcing environment is very often it's outed, it's quickly, and people are not, whether they believe it or not, is another part of the issue here. But I think the democratization title that David came up with really fits what we're trying to describe here. And it's changing as we speak. And I think that we're trying to leave it with, watch out, because it's not going to ever go back to where it was.
That's a fascinating point, is the broadening of the scope to include a wider range of stakeholders. I think we're seeing more integration with the private sector as well. Maxar is a good example. Can you speak to this a little bit?
Yeah, I can take a whack at that, but I'm sure Ken has more. To me, the most remarkable thing is that, you know, the U.S. government knows what it knows, but it often doesn't like to say what it knows because it's ever sensitive to sources and methods. And in many cases, that's, of course, legitimate. So how we get around this little conundrum is we point to things in the unclassified sphere that we know from classified means, right? So we know it's accurate from oftentimes classified means. And so we can point to that, or I guess we, the government, can point to that to confirm what they otherwise might not be able to say, right? So they say, oh, well, you know, look over here if you'll check this out. And so I think the big step forward isn't that we're using, or that the government is using unclassified means to sort of point to classified conclusions. I think we've been doing that for quite some time. But I do think it's a great step because it helps us when, so there's more, let me back up. There's more information to point to, right? So it used to be, oh, well, you just have to hope that a story runs in the New York Times that you can point to or something. But now, you know, with all of the feeds, all of the technology, which I think Ken will get into some of the various ways, there's just more out there. And I think, you know, just from a citizen's point of view, you know, it's never great when the government just says, trust us, right? Or just says, you know, well, take our word for it. And so you can actually now point people to say, okay, you know, look at the massive amount of troops on the Ukrainian border, right? It's even showing up in Google Maps as a traffic jam, right? So there's all of these things now where you don't necessarily have to just sort of, you know, take with blind faith what the government or what the intelligence community is putting out. People have their own really convincing ways to verify things.
Yeah, if I could, Jen, just add some comments to David's analysis there. Look, there's nothing new about commercial intelligence being part of, as Dave is talking about, the government process, about, you know, intel agencies and analysts being able to rely upon some of these new and emerging sources to do just what he's talked about, to be able to share more broadly their analysis, to, you know, be able to point to a different source than a classified one. I think, again, what the newness is the availability of all of this to the private individual, not the private sector. And what has really astounded me, and David and I talked about it, is seeing people using their own money, sometimes crowdsourcing it for some money, to buy imagery. Because none of the, you know, sometimes this is free imagery, but a lot of times they've got to pay for it, and it's not cheap. And that's why the government has been in that business for some time. But we're seeing certainly in this crisis, in this war, is an aptitude for people to find out what does work, what imagery constellations they want to use, how they get it, how they how they know what it's going over their target at the right time. But then it goes beyond that. There's the mapping programs that are out there that allow them to take that and do, as David points out in the article, things that only an intelligence agency would have been able to do, you know, years ago, whatever that that time frame might be exactly. And so it's really just an amazing thing to watch as we're not talking dozens, we're not talking hundreds, we're talking thousands of people attacking this problem with their own niche, not only capability, but their own desire to add to the cause, and maybe actually using their own wealth to spend on acquiring some of this data, which, as David says, is very often free, normally cheap, but is also, as we touch upon, it's sometimes in that gray area, especially when you get in a bellingcat.
This is really interesting for the sort of the conception of secrecy that we have of the government and intelligence and behind closed doors. And it appears that this might be changing. And you talk about the changing nature of secrecy and how that could affect operational security, including the possibility of achieving surprise. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's important to note the changing nature of secrecy because the modern battlefield is absolutely awash in data, in sensors, in information, and intentions may still be hard to discern, but indications and warning are probably a lot easier now than they have been before. And so to answer your question, just by way of example, and in terms of operational security, we always like to talk about democratized imagery intelligence, right? With Maxar, Google Images, or whatever. But it was interesting for me to dig up a little example of democratized signals intelligence, in which citizens in Ukraine have intercepted unencrypted Russian military radio transmissions, either Russians talking to each other or Russians on mobile phones calling back home. And then they translate into English the juiciest parts and make Twitter feeds about them. And this, of course, goes to the information campaign. So we've actually learned quite a lot about Russian soldiers' morale, or the very sorry state of Russian soldiers' morale, thanks to democratized SIGINT. And I think we've also learned a lot about some of the pressures that Vladimir Putin is facing when the Ukrainians, for instance, intercept officers, saying, "Damn these orders, what kind of fool is making us do this sort of thing?" And then when you add that with all of the various complaints on Russian Telegram, for instance, ultra-nationalists complaining about how the war is kind of fought with one hand tied behind their back. And pretty soon you start to build up a pretty good picture of what the Russian soldiers are thinking, what the officers are complaining about, and the sorts of pressures that Putin might be under.
Yeah, if I could just tag on to that. Certainly, I think, Joe, where you're getting after it is the statement that we could make that there's very little that will be able to remain secret on the new battlefield, even if it's in a desert. And I guess that would be the one place where you'll certainly have less sensors and less data. But as I said, people are using overhead systems now to track that. So even there, it's no longer going to be opaque. So in this new paradigm, if it can be observed, and it will be, it will also now likely, because of the democratization, be reported. So in other words, there are many people who are going to be looking for that data, and there are individuals looking for a claim to fame for taking the picture of that whatever that's going to go viral. So I think that's the real shift that we're seeing here as we started this conversation with the data is ubiquitous, as Dave is saying, but modern militaries will have to reckon with that. The larger the formation, the more likely it will be observed and tracked. But all formations down to individual soldiers will have that potential for being spotted, tracked. And then as we're talking about, it's more than that, because that's just putting something up on a map. It's really about this democratization of the analysis that I think has come the furthest on this whole thing. So as David notes, being an intelligence professional, the take a lot of time on teaching people how to take this data and deal with it, and how to verify data, and how to use multiple sources. This is what we're seeing out there. And again, it's based on passion. It's based on people's interest in it, which is just amazing. I mean, we've looked at this. Everybody is following the Oryx site, which is the tracker of the major weapons losses confirmed, either destroyed, abandoned, or captured, right? And it's just an amazing thing that they're tracking well over 1,500 Russian tanks. They're doing it both on the Russian and Ukrainian side. But there's also a tracker out there on Russian officers killed. So again, something that somebody feels so strongly about that they want to create a space and not only put out their analysis of it, but allow others to weigh in either with their own collect, because they've discovered something, be it in an obituary or a picture of a funeral that gets popped out there on the internet or whatever it is, but doing the due diligence to test and say, wait a minute, is that really the picture there geolocated to the right place in Russia? Or do we know anything in open source about that unit? Were they actually involved in combat? So these are things, again, that you couldn't have dreamed of, I don't think, certainly a decade ago. But I don't, as Dave and I point to, I think this is just a taste of what's to come, because people are really enjoying this conversation that they're able to have, and their ability to shine in the spotlight of fame.
Jen, if I can just add to that, you know, one of the things that I've noticed, and I don't think anyone is making a secret of, is that, the analysts, they've taken sides, and so just because we can know something doesn't mean that we ought to share something. And I've been sort of, interested from a moral or an ethical lens in, for instance, if you look at, and I haven't looked at it in a little while, but the Institute for the Study of War, has Russian trackers, right? And they're looking very closely at what the Russians are doing, and that comes out. But they're not showing, what the Ukrainians might be doing. In the same way, there's lots of stuff about, what the Russian problems are. You see a lot less about what the Ukrainian vulnerabilities are, and so while it's true that there is a way to know things and there is an objective assessment, from a moral or an ethical lens, I think because many observers have felt that there's a clear wrong and a clear right in this case, that, people have sort of, not been as interested in trying to sort of discern Ukrainian moves or to document Ukrainian moves as they have been to try to document Russian moves. And so, it's not a substitute for, full analysis. We're analyzing the things that we want to analyze out there as well.
I want to shift the lens a little bit. We saw some very interesting use of intelligence at the outbreak of this conflict in terms of what I would term strategic declassification, public exposure of intelligence information to basically pre-bunk the narrative. How does that play into this concept of democratization of intelligence?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And, I think this was almost entirely driven by Washington and by Whitehall, this idea that we're going to start pre-bunking things. Maybe it's a lesson learned from being caught a little bit flat-footed in Crimea in 2014. I think to their credit, the governments, in Washington and London decided that they were going to try to get out ahead of this thing. Is that going to, deter Putin, right? Just because we've pre-bunked, whatever your false narrative is? Probably not. I think, though, that, as interesting as this was, I think it reflected the very high confidence that both the U.S. and the U.K. intelligence communities had in their assessments. But it didn't move the needle in Paris. It didn't move the needle in Berlin. In fact, it didn't even entirely move the needle in Kyiv itself. Lots to think about there. But I do think that getting it right in most ways, and we did get it wrong in others, and Lieutenant General Barrier, the DIA director, owned that when we thought the Ukrainians wouldn't last, as long as they did, and he said publicly in his testimony that that wasn't the right call, and we were going to look into why that is. But overall, getting it right really has exorcised a lot of the demons from the intelligence failures, I think. From the WMD failures in Iraq in 2003, there was an article not long ago that said something like the intelligence community has its mojo back, and so I think this sort of talking to the American people was a net good, but just on balance, I am a little nervous about using intelligence publicly as a well that we should revisit multiple times. Intelligence exists to inform policy, of course, but I'm less comfortable with intelligence-led public policies because intelligence is not a crystal ball. We do get it wrong sometimes, and I would hate for other major policy decisions to be taken. Well, hey, look, this is what the intelligence says, because it's inevitable that intelligence is going to get it wrong. And I would hate for us to then go back to a 2003 type, time where, when we do get it wrong, that we lose credibility with allies. We lose credibility with the American people. And so, you know, it was a good strategy. It worked well this time. I don't want to take anything away from that, but I wouldn't want this to be the new template for all challenging public policy or foreign affairs decisions going forward.
And I'd just add to that, obviously, each war and each scenario is going to be different. We should not assume that the access to the information will be similar, and therefore that, as Dave has pointed to, that understanding of being able to put it out there with the confidence might not be there in a future environment. So I agree with David that it might not necessarily be the model. However, back to our democratization concept, there's probably, if you were to poll, I would think there would probably be an expectation for folks now that it's going to happen more because, again, they've been exposed to so much more information. They're going to want their government to come in and either correct the facts or to confirm what they already know. So I think the pressure is going to be on. But as we said, it depends on the scenario and what collect and what analysis is out there.
I think that's the expectation point is a great one, because, for instance, you know, the UK's Ministry of Defense, has their Twitter updates going, and they put out an analytical, I think, a three bullet generally line every day on Twitter. And it really has been useful. You know, look, it's not earth shattering. You know, it's not the world's most exquisite human. But it is useful. And I think it does reflect a considered judgment. And, for people that aren't watching this stuff, 24/7, it gives you a good little taste of, kind of what's going on. People don't like to give stuff up. And now that they have it, it's going to be very hard, I think, especially because it's been so well received. I think it would be very hard to see that not come in some future conflict. And actually, I think it's worthwhile, instead of, how we've been doing it in the U.S. is, we have on the record briefings and off the record briefings and all that kind of stuff, having something that, that everybody can have, a one slide, three bullet update on Twitter might not be the worst thing.
There's an interesting dynamic that's emerging in terms of the private individual becoming a player in the relationship with the expert and analyst and potentially the military decision maker. We're increasing the number of players in this dynamic. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I'll try to start. I think, being in government now, I know that there's an appetite for decision makers to see different points of view, obviously, and different analytic judgments. And with this proliferation of analysis, democratized analysis out there, I would certainly think that this appetite has been not only amplified, but there's an expectation for it going forward. And this becomes, somewhat of the dilemma that has always befuddled the intelligence community. I mean, it was always a challenge when that policymaker wanted to be the best analyst there. And, just give me all the stuff and I'll figure this one on out. So I think this is going to be now on steroids as there will be this multitude of potential nuanced analysis out there to select from. And the challenge comes in the analytic integrity standards of the IC are documented and enforced, and people sort of understand what they can and can't say. Whereas in this privatized, democratized thing, even though you might have sourcing along with it, how you get to key judgments and what your confidence level and all those other types of things, or even a track record, won't be part of the equation. And so I think that's one of the challenges going forward.
One of the things that I've seen maybe here in London, which has been interesting, is the number of closed door sessions about Ukraine hosted, for instance, by the British Academy, amongst others, where government people and think tank people and academics are all brought together to compare notes and talk about what's going on. And I went to one of these earlier in the year, and it reminded me a little bit but in its distinction, actually, between my previous life being both a PhD candidate in Cambridge on the outside, but then a reserve officer at Molesworth, just north of Cambridge on the inside. And there would be the Molesworth folks would invite Cambridge academics to come and talk about stuff. And it was sort of imbalanced because it was always a one-way valve, right? You know, the academics would show up and say their piece and everyone would take notes, but no one would ever kind of hit the ball back. You know, it was a very boring tennis match. But the thing that is remarkable to me now is that there's so much less of a power imbalance because everybody knows basically the same stuff. And so it's no longer, you know, well, what can the academics tell us that we don't already know? It's now we're basically reading from the same sheet of music and we all kind of know the same stuff. And so what that allows us to do in the sort of public-private partnership is it allows us to move along from, you know, information exchange. Of course, it's never an exchange, but you know what I mean, to actually inference strategies. And how do you assess, how do you analyze all the things that we're seeing in common, right? So we're not just trying to collect information or make sure we know everything. We've now moved along to talking about what does it all mean? And really it's that insight and that analysis where then we can take it back. You know, academics can take it back and write better, you know, better articles, and the military and the government folks can take it back and hopefully provide better briefings and better insight for their leaders. So, you know, I think that's even in the last, say, you know, 10, 12 years, I think this has been a significant change.
You argue that democratization will shape the conduct of war. What are the implications of this?
Well, I think there's a couple ways that you know, as Ken said earlier, there's no putting this genie back in the bottle, right? This has to be dealt with. And so I do think that it will shape war in a couple of different ways moving forward. The first one is to expose disinformation. And that could be, for instance, you know, the downing of Malaysian Air MH17 over Ukraine, where the Russians tried to spin some insane story, and Bellingcat, you know, provided a very compelling rebuttal to that. So, you know, or pre-bunking disinformation with crisis actors and that sort of thing. So I think exposing disinformation is a key one. Another one, and we've been seeing this already actually, is documenting war crimes. So the Russians in particular have fought, you know, the way, frankly, they've always fought, you know, in Grozny or in Syria or wherever. But now, because the modern battlefield can record so much, can capture so much, you know, the internet isn't going to forget stuff, right? It's not going to forget war crimes. And so I think there's already been a Russian soldier convicted in a Ukrainian court of executing a civilian. And I think that's just, you know, the tip of the iceberg. In addition, it complicates who is a combatant. Is a civilian taking pictures of a Russian column going through their neighborhood and then posting it on social media? Is that person a combatant? Yeah, I'm not a lawyer. I don't have the answer to that question, but I could see the Russians arguing that they are. I think it will also complicate denial and deception, as we saw in the recent Kharkiv offensive, where the Ukrainians did pull off a pretty neat deception operation that I'd called in a different piece, the Kherson ruse, signaling at Kherson and giving the Russians what they want to believe anyway, and then going after Kharkiv. But no doubt that any denial and deception planner is going to have to take the democratization of intelligence into account, because there's now a million different ways that your operation can go sideways based on random, let's call them, you know, intelligence collectors out in the middle of the street.
I would just add my two cents, and it could be probably another podcast, certainly for Army War College, would be with this ubiquitous data out there that the private or the individuals are willing to use, in changing the character of war, we should be looking at, does the U.S. military or other militaries actually act on that same data? So in other words, we have decision-making processes that verify data that we can trust. But with this democratization, it's all going to be out there. And with speed being the key to success, as we're seeing in this war, obviously, that initial period of war, will that affect decision-making going forward and policies going forward on can we use data that's not ours, that we might not be able to trust explicitly, but is relevant to the fight right now. So I offer that as one addition to that, how it could change everything.
In addition to that, one of the things that Ken and I talked about that didn't make it into the article was, does it do anything for the U.S. military in terms of using its resources better? Right. So, can we free up people? For instance, how many people do you really need tracking aircraft kills? How many people do you need tracking tank kills? Is it really that necessary when, instead of having, a team at every, command looking at this, what if you could just have one person whose collateral duty was going to the Oryx website and just grabbing that data? Does that let us use our resources better as military or as intelligence professionals, and enable us to do more things or different things or more with less, right? Does it matter for the way we go about our business practices because you sort of have things that you can essentially place pretty high confidence in that you yourself don't generate?
Thank you. Any other concluding remarks on intelligence in Ukraine?
None from me. Thank you. I think we've hit the main points, and I appreciate you having us on, and I enjoyed the conversation.
Same here. I can't think of anything else to add. I think we covered all the points and then some.
Thank you to Mr. Ken Stallworthy and Dr. David Geo for joining us today. It was great speaking with both of you. And thanks to all of you for listening in. Please send us your comments on this program and all of our programs, and send us suggestions for future programs. Please subscribe to A Better Peace on your podcatcher of choice. And after you have subscribed, please rate and review this podcast, because that's how more people can hear about us so that we can continue to grow this community for conversations like this one. This conversation is over, but we look forward to welcome you again. Until next time, from the War Room, I'm Genevieve Lester.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.